Hello and thank you for joining us. I am Dr. Naval Davar, Associate Professor at the MD Anderson Cancer Center in Houston, Texas, and I'm pleased to be joined today by my two colleagues, Dr. Jessica Altman, who is an Associate Professor at the Northwestern University Feinberg School of Medicine, and Dr. Alexander Pearl, who is an Associate Professor at the Abramson Cancer Center at the University of Pennsylvania. Together, we will do our best to provide you with the latest evidence in the treatment and management of AML as we explore the continually evolving landscape and what this means for you and your patients. These are our disclosures. As we go through our presentations, we will spend just a moment to address a few of the most pressing issues as it relates to both starting new treatments and maintaining patients on treatment at this time. So to begin with, a slide that you have probably seen maybe in different formats but showing you similar data is that mutational profiling in acute myeloid leukemia is no longer something that is being done in the research arena or only in academic centers. It is now a standard approach both in newly diagnosed untreated acute myeloid leukemia as well as in relapsed acute myeloid leukemia. And it is being used both for prognostication because we know that on top of cytogenetic information, molecular data can add an additional layer of prognosis. As you see in this slide, the big group, what we called intermediate cytogenetics for many decades, when you overlay the molecular information, this group gets split quite significantly into patients who may have intermediate cytogenetics but could have 80% or higher long-term survival, which is quite favorable, as good as people with favorable cytogenetics. On the other hand, if you have quote-unquote intermediate cytogenetics but high-risk mutations such as RUNX1, ASXL1, TP53, and others, you may actually have outcomes that are as bad as those with complex or poor cytogenetics. The point being, molecular information is very, very critical to prognostication. And of course, as we will discuss more and more with Dr. Pearl and Dr. Altman through this session, it is also critical for selecting optimal therapies or combination of therapies frontline and in the relapse setting. When we look at specific mutations, the most common mutations in acute myeloid leukemia are NPM1 and FLT3, and these two mutations also tend to co-occur. This is the ELN classification. The NCCN has a similar classification. They both actually agree on most of the major points, and either one I think is a good tool to use for prognostication. I don't need to go through all of these details, but the one point I want to make here is that single mutations usually do not convey the full prognostic picture. So if you look at the underlying sections, FLT3, for example, can fall in favorable, intermediate, and adverse groups depending on the allelic ratio and the co-occurrence or non-co-occurrence of NPM1. So you do need to know the coexistence of NPM1 and the allelic frequency to make a true prognostic determination of FLT3. And this is something that we're seeing more and more with coexisting mutations that may significantly change the prognosis with other patterns as well. So looking at potential targets that are either in development or already have been US FDA approved in the last few years, the big ones are FLT3, FLT3 mutation, one of the most common mutations with a number of FLT3 inhibitors that we'll talk about, IDH1 and 2, for which there are inhibitors that have been approved in relapse and specific frontline settings. And then the big one that we are using quite frequently, which is not truly mutation specific, but is more of an important pathway that is predominantly active in almost all AMLs, BCL2, with the drug venetoclax showing great activity in combination of hypomethylating agents and other combinations such as chemotherapy, FLT3, that we will also talk about. And then there are other less common ones that may also be targetable and drugs in the pipeline, such as menin inhibitors for MLL translocations, FLT3 inhibitors that may have activity against C-Cybl, and then drugs such as APR and CD47 that may have specific activity in TP53 AML. So when you look at this, you can clearly see there has been a tremendous progress, not only in the research arena, that was going on for about 15, 20 years, and a lot of the breakthroughs in research identifying molecular mutations as well as different pathways has led to the clinical successes with 8 drugs approved in the last 2.5 years by the US FDA for the treatment of AML. And the train is not stopping here, which is a good thing. There was recent phase 3 data for oral CC486 or oral hypomethylating agent that also met a phase 3 endpoint in the maintenance and could be a 9th drug potentially approved. So Dr. Pearl, I'm going to turn this over to you.
And so we know a lot about how to approach our patients, and there have been a lot of data in terms of new therapies and a general approach to treating patients, which I show here. So basically, you do need to weigh two things in terms of how best to treat your patient. The first is, are they eligible for intensive chemotherapy? And if so, what are their genetics to inform which therapy would be best? For patients ineligible for an intensive chemotherapy, largely our strategies have been HMA-based, primarily with venetoclax these days. And in some patients, we've added in targeted inhibitors such as IDH inhibitors when appropriate. And in a few patients, we've used FLT3 inhibitors if, for example, we couldn't cytoreduce them otherwise. If we look at data that were presented at the ASH meeting this year, it gives us useful information in terms of how we can parse through these data to best allocate our patients for therapies. As you saw in the patients who were fit for intensive chemotherapy, genetic determinants may lead to therapeutic choices, meaning for certain genotypes, we may recommend one induction strategy over another. And the question has always been, is it safe to wait until you have some data about your patient? So the data have largely come in not from prospective studies, but from retrospective analysis. And this is a study presented from a German group that was presented at the ASH meeting this past year that showed that a delay of as long as 2 weeks of therapy actually did not have a negative impact. Here I'm showing the delay of less than 5 days or more than 5 days in younger or older patients. And as you can see, if patients were going on to intensive therapy, that delay did not negatively impact their survival. So we can feel pretty comfortable saying we need a little bit of time to figure out what the best therapy is. But now we've got other priorities. We need to not only declare fitness, genetics, but also does this patient have a coronavirus infection? We're doing that testing, but it's variable in terms of how fast this comes back. In some centers, you may know within a matter of minutes to an hour, and in some centers, you might have to send this out and you get answers within a few days. I think we can say from these data that you can safely wait for a few days to figure out whether your patient should undergo intensive therapy. And yes, if we are finding that patients have coronavirus infection at the start of therapy, we really think hard about, do they need immediate institution of induction therapy? Again, for some patients that really makes sense, such as APL, and in other patients that might not make sense. Lastly, we have to recognize that our tests have limitations, and there are patients who might not be picked up by a nasopharyngeal swab because the sensitivity is not 100% of this test. For this reason, at my center, we've been doing CT scanning, although I can't say at all that this is an evidence-based recommendation. And certainly, we have picked up patients based on screening of either chest X-ray or CT scanning to find infiltrates that we wouldn't otherwise have found by symptoms. As we assess our preparedness to treat the patient, as I mentioned before, we do need to look at the preparedness of various aspects of our system. How ready is your leukemia unit? How ready is your ICU? Do you have adequate PPE? And you have to assess that on your own and weigh the alternatives. Will this patient be adequately cared for in terms of if they pick up a coronavirus infection, can you give them transfusion support in the outpatient setting? You have to think of all those things before you start therapy. So now you have to discuss that with your patient. You need a therapeutic discussion about what to expect that's really thorough as to all the pros and cons. Intensive, lower intensity. If they choose for intensive therapy, no visitors. Even in our outpatient setting, we are not allowing visitors into our infusion suite. For older patients in the hospital setting, this can be a real risk for delirium, and we're very nervous about sending patients to skilled nursing facilities at discharge. So we want to make sure the patients that we induce or otherwise have a long hospital stay really come out strong. We have not run into issues of ICU availability or rationing of critical care at my institution, and having talked to other physicians elsewhere, that has largely not been a limitation. I don't know that that's going to be a permanent lack of limitation, but thus far that hasn't been something that plays much into our decision making. So if the question is, can your patient get intensive therapy? As far as I can tell, the ICU will be there, at least in our center, and hopefully in yours. But complications, as mentioned before, could be higher in the era of coronavirus, and we need to be prepared for those. That's not to say that we won't run into problems in the outpatient setting. As I mentioned before, the risks of social distancing also include that a family member who would be a caregiver could get infected, and that might limit whether your patient is appropriate for outpatient therapy. So what are the therapies we can give? I will quickly go through treatments in terms of, again, the 2020 BC before coronavirus recommendations, and just remind you that as we're getting better at treating AML, don't forget that we can give these therapies and be more likely to be successful. I do think that avoiding complications includes making it most likely your patient goes into remission and stays in remission, because it's very hard to treat relapsed AML in the current setting. We have less guarantees that we can give therapy that won't put patients at risk and that we can quickly go to a transplant thereafter. Everything that involves the word transplant, in my experience, has been delayed because logistical hurdles involved with working up donors, particularly unrelated donors, and scheduling patients for coming into the hospital for these transplants. So whenever possible, when we can use chemotherapy-only strategies, we like to. This is particularly true for core binding factor patients, who I think should be using gemtuzumab frontline based on data from this meta-analysis from the UK, MRC, which was published about 6 years ago, showing a substantial improvement in overall survival, pooling multiple studies looking at adding gemtuzumab to frontline intensive chemotherapy. For patients who have therapy-related AML or MDS-related AML, we're sort of on a bit of a decision tree algorithm that's tricky here, because we know that CPX351 improves overall survival in this group. But largely, if we look at where that benefit comes from, again, it comes from patients who go to transplant, shown on the right, and not so much when you look at the analysis of the survival when censored for transplant. So if patients in this group aren't going to go to transplant, it's not clear to me that they benefit over 7 and 3. But what is a little bit encouraging from this is some centers can deliver CPX351 in the outpatient setting. If yours is one of these, that may be a reason to think about that therapy, if the risk of acquiring and or managing coronavirus is going to be greater in your inpatient setting than in outpatient. For FLT3 mutated patients, we have prospective data from the RATIFY study that led to the approval of midostaurin based on the demonstration that in a head-to-head study where midostaurin was added to intensive frontline chemotherapy in induction, consolidation, and maintenance, that survival was better in these patients, all of whom had FLT3 ITD or TKD mutations at initial diagnosis, and many of whom went on to transplant. And again, because transplant is part of this equation, we also have to think about, can we get these patients to remission and then to transplant? And increasingly, we have to think about, once patients go to transplant, can we think about post-transplant maintenance, which was not part of this study, but might be something to think about in this patient population where it may improve the event-free survival, and we still don't know how much that impacts overall survival with long-term follow-up using agents that are now approved for this population, but at present are off-label. This includes midostaurin, this includes sorafenib, this includes gilteritinib, none of which has a maintenance indication in the U.S., but all of which could be considered in that setting. Venetoclax plus azacitidine or decitabine has been shown to be a highly active regimen in a wide group of patients over the age of 65 with newly diagnosed AML. We know that the data from the frontline phase 3 will be soon available. We don't have these in our hands just yet. But we hear encouraging things from press release regarding those data, and we hopefully will know whether this really is a therapeutic advance over existing therapy with azacitidine alone. What I can say is the higher remission rates are very heartening. The fact that responses are very quick is heartening, and I think getting patients better blood counts quickly is really important in older patients or in anyone who's not a good candidate for intensive chemotherapy, and this includes a number of patients with higher risk genetics. Again, this might be somebody who you would look at intensive chemotherapy in the era before COVID and now say, I might want to think about using a venetoclax-HMA combination and use that as my preferred strategy. We recently saw the data from venetoclax plus low-dose cytarabine, which did show trends to better outcomes, certainly higher response rates, but not clearly better survival. This was recently published in Blood. And again, we don't yet have the data on venetoclax plus azacitidine, but those will be available soon. I would point out that once frontline therapy stops working, outcomes have been very poor in patients treated with venetoclax frontline. This was presented at ASH this past year. And so we do have to think about if patients are in the relapse and refractory setting, do we have options we can really help our patients with? And can we avoid the heartbreak of patients having unnecessary hospitalizations where they will be separated from their families for a limited amount of time? What I can say is it seems most likely that patients getting targeted therapies in the relapsed and refractory setting will be benefited from those low-intensity approaches, and we should be very careful about who we offer high-intensity salvage chemotherapy to. Lastly, I do want to point out one very important update. That is that there are data that say that hypomethylating agents given after completion of chemotherapy can lead to substantial improvements in event-free survival and, on this study, overall survival. This is the prospective randomized control study of CC486, which is an oral azacitidine formulation compared to a placebo control, where a statistically significant improvement in overall survival was seen. And I would point out that these are patients who did not go to transplant but received CC486 or completion of either induction or any amount of consolidation chemotherapy up to 3 cycles. So realistically, this could be looked at in terms of using hypomethylating agents for patients in remission in which either a delay to transplant is planned or no transplant is planned until we know better how the pandemic is going to play out. So just to conclude, don't hold back curative therapy due to the pandemic. We should avoid deep or prolonged nadirs if at all possible. At my center, we've been lowering the dose of cytarabine in the post-remission setting for all of those other than core binding factor patients. We've been dropping to 1.5 grams per meter squared for high-dose Ara-C consolidation. And when possible, we're giving that therapy at home through home chemotherapy administration by visiting nurses. We are using GCSF support to decrease the duration and or depth of their nadirs. And when possible and appropriate, we're using venetoclax and hypomethylating agents. We're trying as much as possible to avoid intensive chemotherapy for relapsed and refractory patients who may do better with lower intensity approaches, whether that's a venaza approach or whether that's using a targeted agent going after FLT3 or IDH mutations. And for non-high-risk APL patients, we're avoiding steroid prophylaxis. As you're probably already doing, telemedicine and video medicine has become the new normal for us. We're trying to do as much in the outpatient setting. And for patients who really do need referral for transplant, do not wait, because if your patient needs a transplant, you can absolutely expect delays. It's just logistically so much harder to plan transplant these days. And if a donor becomes positive for coronavirus infection, that can really push you back behind the eight ball in terms of knowing you can move ahead.
I think we'll move on with Jessica, and you're going to focus on the relapsed refractory patients. Please go ahead.
Thank you. When we think about considerations of next treatments for patients with relapsed and refractory disease, of foremost in my mind is the patient a transplant candidate? And if so, is he or she interested in transplant? And what are the donor options? We don't want to be in a situation where we have considered and proceeded with an intensive chemotherapy approach for relapsed and refractory disease when the patient is not interested in a stem cell transplant or there are lacking donor options. The vast majority of time, we are able to provide sources of donors for almost all patients, whether that be matched sibling donors, unrelated donors, haplo donors, or cord blood transplants. When we think about the options for treatment of relapsed and refractory disease, it's also important to think about the length of a prior remission. The length of one of the predictors of response to another line of intensive chemotherapy is the length of a prior remission. Also, we need to know what's going on with the patient. Do they have active infection, including coronavirus and the multitude of other infections that our patients are at risk for, and their other medical conditions? And as I mentioned when I started this, really the burden of therapy, including hospitalizations, trip to the medical center, are of great importance, especially in the current era. So as I alluded to, there is not one optimal regimen. What I think is first and foremost in our patients is there a target? Is there something that we can treat them with that targets a specific mutation? And the ones that we have at our disposal today that are approved are targeted therapies against FLT3 and IDH1 and IDH2. It is rare for me to give a talk that's kind of on book or on par of what the approved therapies are, but you'll see as I go through my talk that I'll be talking about approved therapies. When we turn to novel section, we'll hear more about what the next up-and-coming therapies are and what the areas of clinical research are. When we're thinking about therapies, it's important to understand the urgency of achieving a remission. The targeted therapies, while may work as well or better than intensive chemotherapy in certain settings, may take longer, specifically those with the IDH inhibitors. And that's important for us to counsel our patients about in terms of the timing of response. I'm a big believer, and I think all of us are, that investigational therapy is always a priority. A well-designed clinical trial for relapsed and refractory disease is of highest importance to us. And it's especially important in today's setting and those with highly unfavorable genotypes and those without targetable mutations, and certainly those who are not fit for intensive chemotherapy. So I'd like to speak a little bit about the data of targeting IDH1 and IDH2. These are not meant to be comparative. I just have both agents on one slide. When we look at ivosidenib, the IDH1 inhibitor, there was a large multi-center trial that treated 179 patients with relapsed and refractory IDH1 mutated AML. The overall response rate was 42%. And the CR and CRh rate was 30%. So this clinical trial led to new nomenclature of a CRh. A CRh requires no evidence of acute leukemia in the bone marrow or other sites, and a neutrophil count of 500 and a platelet count of 50. That's essentially a CR that allows one to go on with their life. And one, it is different from a morphologic leukemia-free state. It's also different from a CRi or a CRp when we have reasonable both platelet count and neutrophil count, and not just one of those parameters. The median duration of response was 8 months, and many patients also became transfusion independent. One thing that I'll mention with both ivosidenib and enasidenib is there is a series of adverse events that are important, and we'll spend a little bit of time going through them. That adverse event is considered and called the IDH differentiation syndrome. And grade 3 IDH differentiation syndrome with ivosidenib was 4% in this clinical trial. When we look at enasidenib, there was a multi-center study, again, in 214 adults, the vast majority of them with relapsed and refractory IDH2 mutated disease. And there were some patients that we'll hear about in a moment with newly diagnosed disease who were deemed unfit for other therapies. Their overall response rate was 40%, with a CR rate of 19%, and a median duration of response of 6 months, with a median overall survival of 9 months. Differentiation syndrome was again seen in this agent, and additional side effects that were seen at a high rate were hyperbilirubinemia. It doesn't tend to impact the continued treatment, and nausea. So I'd like to share a case of a patient of mine. Catherine is an 83-year-old woman with a history of obstructive lung disease. She also had lung cancer in 1990. She was treated with chemotherapy and radiation. She presented to her primary care doctor with fatigue and was noted to have a white blood cell count of 1.7, a hemoglobin of 11.2, and a platelet count of 139,000. She had a bone marrow biopsy due to the abnormal blood counts, and she was diagnosed with acute myeloid leukemia. You can see her cytogenetics is listed, and she had molecular studies at that time revealing an IDH2 mutation. She was not considered an appropriate candidate for intensive chemotherapy, and the choices at that time in 2015 were to receive either a hypomethylating agent alone, low-dose Ara-C, or a clinical trial. So Catherine enrolled on a clinical trial. She actually enrolled on the front line and the clinical trial with enasidenib that I mentioned previously. The vast majority of the patients who were treated on that trial had relapsed and refractory disease, though there was an arm that allowed patients with newly diagnosed disease who were not candidates for intensive chemotherapy or were not candidates for another therapy. And the decision at that time was for her to enroll on the enasidenib clinical trial. In this subset of patients, there were 39 patients with a median age of 77. Many of them had an antecedent myeloid neoplasm. The median number of cycles given on this trial was 6, though there were patients who were treated upwards of 3 years. And the overall response rate was about 30%, and 18% received CR. So, as I mentioned, Catherine was treated on this study. She enjoyed an immediate clinical response with improvement in her blood counts, but it took a number of additional cycles for her to obtain a complete remission, which she did. She maintained that response for almost 3 years. She then presented for routine follow-up on study after recent COPD exacerbation, and unfortunately, we found that she had recurrent disease with a high white blood cell count and 75% peripheral blasts. Just 4 weeks prior, her blood counts were normal with a normal differential. At that time, knowing what we were learning about the sensitivity of IDH-mutated disease to the combination of HMA and venetoclax, she initiated therapy with azacitidine, and we were still awaiting approval of venetoclax. It was the time period where venetoclax was not yet approved for AML, but was approved for CLL, and we were able to get that agent for many of our patients. Unfortunately, she experienced sepsis, but was recovered. And the molecular studies that I sent when she presented with relapse disease revealed a FLT3 ITD mutation. So we now had choices for Catherine. Do we continue her on the current regimen where she had just recovered from a septic event, or did we offer her another therapy? So I'd like to mention the ADMIRAL data. This was a trial that looked at adults with relapsed and refractory FLT3 mutated disease. So 2-to-1 randomization to receive patients received either gilteritinib at 120 milligrams once daily versus salvage chemotherapy. And the salvage chemotherapy choices were, there were choices of two high-intensity regimens and two low-intensity regimens. Patients were encouraged and able to proceed with stem cell transplant. And those who received gilteritinib and went to stem cell transplant on that arm were allowed to resume gilteritinib post-transplant. This data, the Kaplan-Meier curves and overall survival are shown here. And note that the median overall survival in those who received gilteritinib was 9.3 months versus those who received salvage chemotherapy was 5.6 months. And you can see that the CR and CRH rate was higher in those who received gilteritinib versus salvage chemotherapy. This is true in the arms who received intensive chemotherapy compared to gilteritinib as well, and not just the lower intensity arms. So Catherine. Catherine had had enough of the hospital and had had enough of infusional therapy and decided to receive gilteritinib as part of the expanded access program before the drug was approved. She attained a clinical response, and given that our goals with her, she did not have further bone marrow biopsies. She maintained her clinical response for approximately 6 months, but then declined and entered hospice. Our interest in gilteritinib doesn't stop as a single agent. The three of us and others have been interested in combining and studying gilteritinib in combination with venetoclax. And Sasha presented this data at the last ASH meeting. There has been preclinical data that demonstrated synergy between these two agents. And we developed a phase 1b trial combining venetoclax and gilteritinib. And there are a couple of points that I'd like to mention, that 15 out of 17 of the FLT3 mutated patients achieved a response. And of particular interest to me, and I think to all of us, is even those with a prior TKI exposure obtained a response, and at quite a reasonable rate. We also know now the phase 2 doses are 120 milligrams of gilteritinib and 400 milligrams of venetoclax. It is important to note that there are major drug-drug interactions with venetoclax, and particularly with the azoles and antifungal agents, and so dose reductions of venetoclax are required based on what antifungal agent you're using. It is also important to note that venetoclax in combination with gilteritinib, and in my experience, venetoclax in combination with HMAs leads to significant myelosuppression. And we are still trying to get our arms around the best management of the myelosuppression associated with combination therapies with venetoclax. I wanted to spend the majority of the time talking about targeted therapies, not just because of the era that we're in with the pandemic, but because the data is compelling compared to intensive chemotherapy. I do want to take one moment to mention one option of a newly evaluated intensive chemotherapy approach that was presented at this year's ASH. And as I mentioned before, we need to be mindful that this is an option to offer individuals who we, in the relapsed and refractory setting, who we are confident are going to want to and be able to the best of our knowledge, proceed with a stem cell transplant. This is intensive therapy. And this, again, is also from the MD Anderson, and a trial combining FLAG, idarubicin, and venetoclax was looked at in adults in two cohorts, both newly diagnosed and relapsed and refractory after the phase one dose escalation study. So these were patients with newly diagnosed acute myeloid leukemia who had an adequate performance status and adequate renal function and other organ function. Patients were received a typical FLAG regimen with G-CSF, fludarabine, intermediate dose cytarabine, and venetoclax, the additional agent. And venetoclax was given on days 1 through 14. And the response rate, I'd like to just highlight the folks with relapsed and refractory disease in a patient population where we would expect a response rate in the 30% range. The overall response rate in this patient population was 70%. Granted, it is a limited number of patients, but encouraging to us. And I was particularly encouraged by those patients with an MLL rearrangement who were treated. All of the patients, both with relapsed and refractory disease and newly diagnosed disease treated in this regimen, responded and underwent a stem cell transplant. So just to summarize, the treatment options for those with relapsed and refractory disease in 2020 are shown, and you'll see the emphasis that we place on the targeted therapies. I cannot underscore enough the importance of clinical trials and consideration of being prepared for stem cell transplant.
So talking about what's upcoming, there are surprisingly and excitingly a lot of treatments still upcoming. HMA venetoclax, very exciting, no doubt, especially for certain subsets, NPM1, IDH, RUNX1, the frontline data has been outstanding. However, in the relapse setting, this was a relatively large study we did of decitabine venetoclax, and you can see in the newly diagnosed AML, very nice 90% CR/CRI rates. But in the relapse refractory AML, those numbers are low, 25-30%. And this has been shown by other groups, the Sloan Kettering Group, as well as the City of Hope, have all shown response rates in the range of 30-45% in relapse refractory AML. So we don't think HMA-VEN on its own is going to be the solution in relapsed AML. Maybe you could add things to it, but maybe there are other ways that we could optimize using these combinations. If you block BCL2, one of the major mechanisms of escape is MCL1, and there are now four MCL1 inhibitors actually that are in single agent and moving into combinations with venetoclax. And we think that this combination, at least based on the preclinical data, could be highly synergistic. We have to be careful about tumor lysis, which actually a couple of those combos have been seen, and also cardiotoxicity, which is a known class effect because MCL1 is heavily expressed on the cardiac tissue. But if we can find ways to deliver it, this could be a very, very effective combination, and that's some of the data we are looking forward to. The other drug that indirectly seems to inhibit MCL1 is MDM2, and if you block MDM2, then you actually get P53 reactivation or refunctionalization, and that can downstream block MCL1 as well as enhance other proapoptotic pathways such as PUMA, BIM, BAX, and that could have a kind of a dual beneficial activity in combination with the BCL2 inhibitor. So we recently showed data on a phase 1b trial looking at the combination of this MDM2 inhibitor, there's a number of them. The one that's more advanced in AML development is idesanutlin in combination with BCL2 inhibitor venetoclax. These were older patients above 65 with relapse disease, so quite a high-risk population, and encouraging early response rates, CR/CRI rates, about 50%, which is definitely better than venetoclax alone, which is around 20-25%, or even HMA venetoclax, which is around 40%. But we are continuing the study. We now have an established dose for the combination, which is going to be the 150 of IDESA with venetoclax, and the expansion will probably give us more information as to whether this could be a good combination for our relapsed older AML patients. And we're also going to look at patients who are failing HMA-VEN. This is becoming a very, very important and a very poor outcome population. Other important things to look at are something we kind of discussed, that venetoclax HMA is not universal across the board for all patients. So if you look at the bottom half, NPM1, IDH1 and 2, splice mutant patients, seem to do very, very well. They have responses, as you can see in the left, group A, and the responses are durable for 3 years and beyond in a large majority. But then if you move to the top area, you see the complex, the TP53, and the FLT3-ITD, where most patients either don't have a response, that's group C, or if they have a response in FLT3, the responses are not durable. So the point is that we do a need to personalize therapy even beyond just saying this patient is older or unfit for induction to what is the biological approach for that patient. So more and more we are evaluating new treatments for TP53 and FLT3 either in combination or independent from HMA and venetoclax, and I'll talk about a couple of those. We already discussed the gilteritinib venetoclax. Similar combinations are being looked at with other FLT3 inhibitors like quizartinib as well as midostaurin. Initially as doublets, which are, this is the only one that has been presented, showing high response rates, about double of what we would see with the single agent gilteritinib, quizartinib, second generation FLT3 inhibitor. And the question now is, can you somehow move these in the front line? Of course, we are very, very cognizant of myelosuppression, and this will usually have to be done in a trial setting with early bone marrow evaluation and shortening venetoclax durations. But I think those approaches could be very fruitful, knowing that FLT3 as well as venetoclax are synergistic with HMA on their own and with each other. So look out for that data. The other is TP53, and you know, we have a great tendency to be very excited about everything in the TP53 space, because rightly so, we need something to be excited about. HMA-VEN for a couple of years we thought could be one of the breakthroughs. Initial responses look good, but the duration and survival unfortunately has come down at 6 to 8 months survival, both in the phase 2 as well as in some of our published larger ISD studies. There are now two drugs that we hope will be at least improving the outcome. We don't think necessarily they can be curative. That's a very high bar for TP53. One of them is this drug called APR, which impacts the folding of the P53 protein. And as you see on this data that David Salmon had presented at the recent ASH meeting, response rates were quite high in the AML-MDS populations, where you're seeing upwards of 80% overall response rates. And more impressive to me, a true CR, meaning less than 5% blast, complete recovery of counts of more than 50%. Historically, with HMA alone, published data has shown 15 to 22, 21% true CR rates in this population. So a 50% true CR will hopefully be translated to survival. A phase 3 of AZA-APR versus AZA in MDS, intermediate high, very high risk, is close to completion. And there are triplet approaches of AZA-VEN-APR as well as doublets of AZA-APR in AML-TP53. So this is a drug hopefully to look out for. Now moving to immunotherapies, this is a kind of big emerging area in AML following suit from ALL and lymphoma, where, as you know, immunotherapy has played major roles either as bispecific or CAR-T or antibody drug conjugates. And in AML, we are trying to replicate and are seeing some early successes, especially with the ADC approaches, but hopefully we'll be able to see some similar things with the bispecifics and checkpoints. So we know gemtuzumab is the approved ADC. It's used extensively, especially in core binding factor up front in combination with chemo. There are other ADCs. One of them that we've been working with a number of other centers in the U.S. is a drug called IMGN. This is a CD123 antibody drug conjugate. We showed updated data in relapse patients. Response rate is about 25 to 35% CR/CRI, a little bit better than what we have seen with gemtuzumab. The good thing is it seems quite safe. We don't see a high signal of VOD, and myelosuppression also seems to be less than what we have seen with gemtuzumab and SGN and some other drugs. So this is now in combination with AZA and AZA-VEN in the frontline setting, in a multinational setting, and hopefully will be another potential ADC in the future, now targeting CD123, not only the 33 that we have. The other one that I think is of interest and is in advanced development is a bispecific. So as you know, in ALL, there's a bispecific called blinatumomab, which is a CD3, CD19, targets CD19 on ALL, CD3 on T cells, and brings the T cells in proximity to the ALL cell, resulting in T cell mediated death of the leukemic blast. Similar approach is being tried by many different constructs in AML. One of them that has shown some early signals of efficacy, especially in a high-risk group called primary refractory AML, is a drug called flotetuzumab. And this was data that showed response rates about 25-30%, was updated at ASH 2019, showing that in primary refractory AML, the response rates were about 30-35%, which was encouraging compared to what has been seen historically. And the drug is focusing on that population, as well as on MRD eradication, which has been shown to be effectively done by blinatumomab. The other agents that, of course, from solid tumor, most of you are very, very familiar with our immune checkpoint drugs. We are looking at different combinations of these, PD-1, CTLA-4, doublets of those. Now emerging new checkpoints such as TIM-3, STING, that may actually have specific activity in AML from preclinical data. The completed clinical trial that has been published is HMA with the PD-1 inhibitor. This was one is relapsed AML population, and especially in people who had not had a prior HMA, so people who are failing induction, 3+7, FLAG, IDA, other approaches, we do see a good response rate, overall response rate 50%, CR/CRI 30%, which is better than single agent HMA and in the range we see with HMA venetoclax in relapse population. And especially in the early salvage population, where some of our correlative analysis looking at cytokine production as well as T-cell activity functionally seem to show that it's the early relapses that will maintain T-cell activity. Once you get to advanced salvage, salvage 3 and 4, especially after heavy exposure to purine analogs and transplant, you have very significant abrogation, almost complete negation of T cell activity. So similar to CAR Ts and bispecifics, I think either low burden MRD disease, relapsed AML, first salvage is where these drugs could show benefit. And a lot of the bispecifics and checkpoints are being moved into that area like they did in ALL. Among the exciting drugs that I mentioned for TP53 and also a form of immunotherapy is the CD47 antibody magrolimab. We're quite excited about this agent. There will be a lot of updates on this at upcoming meetings this year. And as you can see, looking at the overall response rates that were shown at ASH this year in the frontline MDS setting, overall response, I think, is tricky in MDS. You know, blasts are low. It's hard to really judge. But a true CR rate of 50% is definitely better than what we have seen. About 15 to 18% CR rate is what we have historically shown with HMAs. And in AML, also the combination is showing some early activity. Now, this is probably lower than what we see with HMA venetoclax, so I don't think head-to-head this would be necessarily better. Can you combine them, of course, is the question, and there are triplets that are going to look at that like we are with APR. But specifically in TP53, where there will be more updated and a larger number of patients presented at some of the upcoming meetings, there seems to be a signal in AML, high response rates, about 75-80%, and durability. So either APR or 47, either with HMA or HMA-VEN, we hope, will show us in the next year or so some exciting data to move forward. And then in MDS, the azamagrolimab is currently in a registration approach, with this current study being expanded to 100 patients, as well as a subsequent phase 3 study, confirmatory study. So these both drugs, APR47, could be, even by the end of this year, potentially agents that we may hear positive data on and potentially get added to MDS AML regimens. Okay, with that, I will move on then to our closing. So thank you all for joining us for this presentation. Hope it is informative and will be useful, and we're happy to be able to provide whatever information, education we can in such a fast-moving field.